Hello, and welcome to the Tech Dirt Podcast. I'm Mike Masnick.
The world is increasingly technological, so we have better get methodical. Bringing precision to critical digital journalism with the singular vision of the modern monocle. Stopping the copyright bullies from pulling the wool on us. Facing and taking on all the blatant pay to troll. Document the ways that they aim to take control. Scrutinize and do their lies and make them fold. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. To grab a shovel and dig up the tech dirt. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get.
A few weeks ago, the Supreme Court heard the Murthy v. Missouri case. And when that case was first filed, it was called Missouri v. Biden, and was basically two states, Missouri and Louisiana, suing the Biden administration, accusing them of secretly colluding with tech companies to censor conservative speech, including all the way back in 2020, before the Biden administration even existed, which I thought was a little bit weird. The case was basically based on vibes. It was unclear why the states even had any standing to sue. So eventually they added some individual plaintiffs who had content removed or had been banned from social media sites. And the crux of the argument was basically the Biden administration scolded companies for not moderating COVID misinfo. These COVID misinfo peddlers were moderated. Therefore, we can blame it on the Biden administration, and somehow that violates the First Amendment. The case seemed so ridiculous to me and so just outright silly that I assumed it would be dismissed relatively quickly. That didn't happen. Instead, it actually seemed to have turned into not just an important case regarding online speech, but one has the potential, in my mind at least, to be one of the more consequential rulings regarding online speech coming from a Supreme Court that is hearing a whole bunch of cases related to online speech. And where I don't think this was supposed to be one of the big ones. I felt like other ones were going to be bigger, but now I'm concerned about that, I guess. We'll see. And so even though we're in this sort of weird purgatory between the case having been heard and whenever the ruling will come out, which isn't likely to be in June, I just keep thinking about the case, including how it's weird on a whole bunch of different levels. And so I wanted to talk through some of that weirdness. And when I want to talk through legal weirdness, who else do we bring on the podcast but law professor Kate Klonick, who has written up a bunch of her views about the case both before and after the Supreme Court heard the case. Welcome back to the podcast, Kate.
I'm so glad to be back to talk about legal weirdness. I didn't know that was what I appreciate. I mean, the thing is that I know how many other like legal experts you have on. So I'm like very happy to be the queen of like legal weirdness as it pertains to the Supreme Court, which I never wanted to have in my kind of my field of vision in the first place, which is why I went into online speech as a topic. But here we are.
Yes. Here we are. So just to get started, like how did this even become a Supreme Court case? And I mean, I think we talked a little bit before we started here, and you were saying, you know, it is important to sort of put this into context with some of the other cases that are going on. So I'm not even sure where to start, but where would you start in terms of putting this case into context and why it became an important Supreme Court case?
I mean, I think we should start probably with Murthy itself, which didn't really even have a name. I think I wrote about it for the New York Times when the district court opinion came out, and I think I called it like Missouri versus Biden. And like, it was just like, it hadn't even kind of really been titled yet. And it was such a weird case, and you're right about it being a weird case, but it's not that weird because it is part of this growing trend of states and state attorney generals taking action against tech companies in the absence of there being an ability to federally regulate and there being no kind of definitely no political consensus, but also no political possibility, but also no kind of like, but also the First Amendment issues being very, very real in like more obviously real in like kind of a federal context. And a lot of these state legislatures and state attorney generals are realizing that they can push it through just like obviously First Amendment violative laws and kind of lawsuits and push them through mm-hmm. and kind of make political hay on them. And so I think that this is like a great example of that. You have Louisiana and Missouri state attorney generals filing this suit. The gist of it is this idea, I hate this term, I think it's like a terrible term that is not at all descriptive of what it actually is, but this term jawboning, which is mm-hmm. the concept of basically kind of the government not directly regulating something, regulating speech in particular, but threatening to regulate it, threatening to enforce legal existing legal laws in a way that they were not previously enforced. As my dad, who's also a lawyer, likes to tell me, there's a lot of law at the end of a nightstick, and I think that is like that is unfortunately kind of the idea of jawboning there. And so, the idea was that you had a bunch of GOP and kind of far right attorney generals, and they were concerned and took up the mantle of like what was kind of a fringe theory coming out of COVID of a lot of individuals that were anti-vax or anti-mask or anti-CDC mandates or anything that mm-hmm. had said, you know, listen, I'm not being listened to. And also, by the way, the platforms are tilted in this way towards the Silicon Valley, like leftism, and I'm being censored. And so these attorney generals took this up and basically accused the Biden administration and various members of government of, calling up essentially people at the platforms and asking them to take down misinformation about COVID and anti-vax information and things like that. And so there's a couple of things to note in how this case got mm-hmm. brought, which is one is that it was in the Western District of Louisiana. And that basically meant because of a bunch of procedural things that there would only be one judge, one Trump appointed judge that would hear the case. And so there was going to be it was like, just why in Missouri? Why in Louisiana? Well, that's your answer right there. Yeah. This was kind of forum shopped to the hilt. The judge was incredibly favorable to this idea and let it kind of proceed through on all this kind of preliminary injunction filings and issued a 151 page decision on July 6th. And I remember that because it was my birthday. And I stayed up all night writing.
I thought it was July 4th.
Oh, it was July 4th. My birthday was July 6th. And so like I stayed up the July 5th. Writing this piece for the New York Times to kind of be like, this decision is horrible. It referenced more Orwell than it did kind of any doctrine. And it was just kind of just this fever dream kind of trial court decision that said like, no, I think that there's enough here. And also just issued a decision in equity, which is the preliminary injunction, which was just incredibly powerful. That doesn't happen super often. It's a harder standard to reach. And it was so big that it kind of made everyone in government pause and be like, wait, are we jawboning? Wait, are you jawboning? Are we all like in having conversations with any private entity? Are we all going to all of a sudden be on the hook for government censorship or like improper influence? And so, being risk averse government officials as they are. So there was a lot of concern this was going to kind of shut down like the normal way that government works, which is of course to have conversations with people and, and to exercise certain amounts of soft power and all these other things. Sorry, this is a long wind up. I promise I'll get to like kind of the payoff in a second. The payoff was that like we kind of were all like, this is a garbage decision. There's no way that this is going to survive. But of course, the Western District of Louisiana is part of the Fifth Circuit. And who the hell knows with the Fifth Circuit these days, Mike? So the Fifth Circuit is they pulled a lucky panel. You don't have to be that lucky in the Fifth Circuit if you're on the right. Which is an important point here. But they pulled a good panel and they affirmed And everyone was like, okay. Like, and they kind of walked back a little, some parts of the preliminary injunction to make it a little less broad. And then it went up and back on like some, I won't get into it, procedural stuff in the Supreme Court before getting picked for writ and for cert and getting pulled and going in on, I think it was heard in early March. It was like a couple of weeks ago.
Mid-March. Yeah.
Yeah. So the way to also can, so that's Murthy. That's the Murthy case. So we're coming up and we're basically asking, okay, on the evidence presented, and I'll get to that maybe later in the podcast, but on the evidence given over to the district court, was there a straight line? Can we see that basically government officials took down government officials, like influenced speech being taken down by private actors
and caused it.
That's what I meant by the straight line and like caused it, traceability. In this context. And if they did, then like that's a violation of the First Amendment and that's a problem.
Right.
The other thing was basically kind of like, where Murthy sits in all of these Supreme Court cases over the past 2 years. And so that's Tom Navi-Gonzalez. That's from last term with the court, which was, you know, famously like a 250,000 words of briefs filed for like a 600-word kind of like decision from the justices. That was kind of the big Section 230 case.
I was going to say, just as a really quick recap for folks who don't remember that, that was like the terrorism cases where the idea was, you know, were Google and or Twitter effectively liable for terrorism by groups that also happened to use Google and Twitter? And the Supreme Court, you know, took that up. And there was a lot of concern that this would come up with some sort of ruling that that somehow impacted Section 230 or online speech. And effectively, the Supreme Court punted on it and said, we're not going to touch any of that stuff. This just seems too far away from what, you know, the terrorist acts were just so disconnected.
Were too attenuated. They weren't going to change the entire standard of review for causality for torts. And then they weren't going to change 230 on the facts that Gonzalez presented, essentially. And I think that is, so like, I want to get back to this, but that is essentially like the what it boils down to, which is that, that the facts were shit. and Gonzalez and Tamna, because this is a theme that comes up again. Sorry, am I allowed to say that word on your
camera? Yeah, sure.
Okay.
No bleeping here.
Okay. But they were bad. They were bad facts.
Yeah.
And if you will remember to the Gonzalez Tamna decision or oral arguments, the general vibe of those oral arguments were kind of like, even from Thomas, who I will get to in one moment. We're kind of like, why are we here? Why are we here? Why are we listening to this case? And the answer, Justice Thomas, is because you asked for these cases. There was a very notable decision in which, I think it was in the Knight v. Biden cases, in which they declined to take the Knight v. Biden, which was the Knight First Amendment Institute kind of decision on Trump, which had been mooted because Biden had come into the administration. This was on Trump blocking accounts on his platform, or excuse me, on Twitter, and whether or not that was a violation of the First Amendment. And that had been a Second Circuit decision. They didn't take cert on it. And in declining to take cert, he had, Justice Thomas had written basically like, but we would love to have some 230 cases, which is where we got Gonzalez with Tamna, which read to me at the time, it was picked. And then definitely by the time we got to oral arguments, although I was very worried, as we all were in the interim, that like, as a, this was like that I thought that the justices didn't know what they were doing, that somebody had been like, oh, this is a good 230 case, and then had picked it out of a hat, having clerked, I'm wearing my clerking softball t-shirt right now, by the way. But anyways,
very nice.
From when I was on the Second Circuit softball team. But basically the idea being that like, they had picked this case for for oral argument and for it to be heard, and that like the Gonzalez case was not very good. Everyone else had been waiting for the net choice case. That obviously came next term, and then Murthy came out of nowhere, right? There have been a couple others on the sidelines, some like kind of employee action kind of issues and other things, and employee speech on Facebook and things like that. But generally speaking, I think that the way to actually see the Murthy arguments is kind of in the context of all of these cases after 25 years, essentially, of no Supreme Court voice on what to make of online speech. The last case, significant case being Reno versus ACLU in 1997, that there's just like all of a sudden this spate of cases, and it's in part because of that directive from Justice Thomas.
Right. So there's one other element of the Murthy case that I think is worth discussing, which you hinted at a little bit in describing Judge Doughty in the district court, you know, put out this crazy ruling, which I remember being on July 4th, because you usually don't get opinions coming out on July 4th. And I think he very much timed it to being on July 4th. And he put in a lot of, you know, very flowery language about how this was like the you know, most, I forget the exact term that he used, but this was like the most egregious case of government censorship he had ever heard of, or something to that effect. But as you start to go through the evidence that he presents, a lot of it is not just misleading, but effectively fabricated, which is weird for a variety of reasons. In some cases, he appeared to insert extra words into quotes or remove certain words from quotes, which made the quotes say perhaps the exact opposite of what they actually said, and a couple of other things like that, which meant that, you know, the case was presented and people who wanted to believe it as, you know, as this really, really important case, were happy to take what the judge claimed was the evidence and accept it on fact, but it was ridiculously misleading. And so like the actual record and the details and the evidence didn't really seem to support what was being claimed. Now, there are some people who still disagree with that. And that created, to me at least, it created this weird situation, though I thought this was kind of interesting but didn't get as much attention. In the Supreme Court argument, at one point, the person making the argument for the Justice Department, who's the Deputy Solicitor General, I think, it basically said, look, if we had done what the states claim we did, that would be a First Amendment violation. And so there is this weird element to the case, which is, yes, if the government had actually done what the states claim misleadingly, or what the judge misread the evidence to say, then that would be a First Amendment violation. And as someone who is a strong First Amendment believer, like, I don't think the government should have the power to tell websites how to act and you know, how to moderate their content. And if that was happening, that would be a problem. And so I personally sort of struggled with this case a little bit, because initially, like, it was clearly a stupid case. The evidence didn't show that. The ruling in the district court was, you know, beyond insane. It was, you know, with made up facts and all this stuff. And then, you know, the Fifth Circuit, it really did, like, while they affirmed the basics of it, they walked back. There were 10 things in the district court's original injunction, and they sort of walked back 9.5 of those. And so it was, you know, without overturning the district court's ruling, it sort of did. And I opined at the time, I thought maybe the administration would leave it alone, because by removing a bunch of the initial injunction, they could sort of function. You could argue that the Fifth Circuit's ruling was basically, you can do everything except violate the First Amendment, which, you know, was a way to read it. But
that's the whole
problem
question,
was like,
because the standard,
yes.
Right. But that's the whole question, because the standard was like, the standard is what comes from Bantam Books, which is a case in which, like, you know, you have police walk into a bookstore and say, gee, it would be a shame if, like, we suddenly decided that these were in violation of the law. Better clear them from your shelves before we decide they're in violation of the law. And that being kind of the high watermark, and I'm being very glib about this because, you know, these are complicated. This is complicated doctrine, but like, that's part of like the problem is like, that's just not telling us that much. That's one very specific case of like finding that to be too much and that to be a First Amendment violation. But like the question of whether the facts of Murthy crossed over were just like, you know, there have been elucidations through the doctrine that is not, that are as ever are, is like impenetrable and not perfect, and like not impenetrable, but indeterminate and not perfect, right? That like the facts don't ever exactly match up in every situation.
Right.
But the Murthy case really kind of like was like, okay, well, maybe that it also presented, I think, for people like us, like I think everyone, like I think I had very much the same feeling. Like I was like, well, if they did this, even though it's, I think the Trump administration did the exact same things, they're not on the hook right now too. Like if this is what they did, then this is bad, right? This is not great. But this is, I want to really get back to this traceability idea, which came up over and over again. And the record, which was at the trial court level, which was essentially like just a nothing burger with nothing on top. And actually, I want to make it worse. It was like with deception mustard or something, right? Like you basically had like, I mean, which is essentially what Sotomayor said. So first of all, I want to like name the principal Solicitor General, Brian Fletcher, who argued the case for the DOJ. What a hero.
Thank you.
The guy was great. I actually, I mean, like I am not, as I said before, like kind of at the thing, I never... There is a reason I went into this area of the law as a law professor and a scholar. I do not buy, I don't like this kingmanship and the total like the obsession with like First Amendment or like, sorry, with like Supreme Court doctrine that I think a lot of law professors have. It's not my area of interest. I don't think it's the most interesting area to like parse what they had for breakfast and then also what they mean by like an Oxford comma. And so like, it's just really like, it's just not my thing. But now here I am and all of these cases have been taken. And so like, if I'm going to be here, thank God for a person like Brian Fletcher, who I thought did a great job and did really very calmly, very evenly kind of answered the questions, had a very firm command, I thought, of First Amendment doctrine, and also the facts in the case. And also, I want to just flag this, the standard of review. So this is like sorry, not to be like the lawyer in the room, but that's what you brought me on here, the weird lawyer. But Sam Alito, like, first off the bat was kind of like, there is this move that you can make, right? Which is like, well, are we going to review this on the facts? Because we shouldn't question the facts. We have to, the standard of review here is like clear error, which means that we just have to take the record for what it is. And this is, by the way, as a legal realist, in my mind, this is all bullshit. Anyone can review anything and call it fact or application whenever they want. And I know that people will argue with me probably in the comments on this podcast, but it's a cover essentially of just stamping. And not looking too hard at the district court opinion. And Alito tried this. And it's just really was clear by the end of oral arguments, he did not have any type of uptake on that. Because as you said, the district court had been so fast and loose with the facts. And in fact, so had the Louisiana Solicitor General, who was also arguing and who was also Alito's clerk, which is like fun drums. Like, because this guy, I wish I could like pronounce his last name. I'm going to do a terrible job of it, but I think it was, Benjamin Aguinaga, mm-hmm. Who is the Solicitor General for Louisiana, is actually just got done clerking for Sam Alito and just got kicked all over the field by like no less than five of the justices, like kicked all over. Like he showed up with just kind of like this, like hey, like first principles, we just love free speech and the First Amendment. Don't you agree? And like, they were like, hey, buddy, we've got some tests for these things. There are rules here. This is not, you're like, this is not Calvin ball. And so it really ended up being this. And then Sotomayor scolded him, of course, which was like the best part.
And she directly called out the fact that, you know, his brief, that she just didn't believe a lot of things in the brief, that the that he appeared to be misleading the court in the briefs. And that you don't often hear. I can't recall ever hearing that happen in the Supreme Court before.
I mean, I think I have the quote here. She said, you know, and I think it doesn't really even come across in the transcript because the tone was so important. But she says, you know, I have such a problem with your brief, counselor. You omit information that changes the context of some of your claims. You attribute things to people who it didn't happen to. At least in one of the defendants, it was like her brother or something that something happened to, not her. I don't know what we make of all of this because I'm not even sure how you prove direct injury in any way. And to have, like, to literally have be standing in front of like the Mecca and have this, like, and have a justice like reach down and be like, you know what, F you for lying to us is crazy. Like, it's like, this doesn't happen. And you can almost like hear the gulp that he like takes and then apologizes profusely to Sotomayor, which is also bad. Like, they kick him all over the field for like 60 minutes. And then finally it's Alito's turn for questions to his former clerk. And he digs him out of this hole and is like, I think what you mean to say is this. And he's like, thank you. Like, you can just like hear his like, kind of like his like, thank you, Justice Alito. And it's just so clear that like Alito looks like an asshole because he's got like this kid who's his former clerk and is in like the Solicitor General position now, just doesn't know his stuff. And all of his colleagues have kind of like duly pointed that out. From both from Amy Coney Barrett to Kavanaugh to Kagan to Sotomayor to even Roberts kind of pitched in at one moment. Anyway, so like it was good fun. It was a good fun oral argument. Kind of a little bit like Tom and Gonzalez, honestly, which was like, I think Eric Goldman, I remember, invited him to do a live chat of the Gonzalez Tomna argument, and he was he was like, no, I can't, because it's just like the internet's gonna end. And I was like, okay, Eric, like, there's like, I don't think it's gonna be. And then like it turned out to not be that bad, because like, you know, they it was like, it was a huge, I mean, I understand Eric's thinking on this, but I feel like there was the same amount of, why is this here, why are we hearing this, what a waste of our time. What a, like, a bunch of non-serious people. And that was, God, that was refreshing. Like, it was it was more than I felt like we deserved or I was expecting.
Yeah. I mean, I did want to call out the there was this interesting moment, or a couple moments really, where both Kavanaugh and Kagan, who had both been former White House lawyers, sort of expressed, like, Alito had said something like, it sounded like he pointed to the press gallery area and was just like, it would be crazy if, you know, the White House was trying to tell the press what to report on, or, you know, that would never happen, we would never stand for it. And both Kagan and Kavanaugh were just like, what are you talking about? Like, 1,000 times a day, people would talk to reporters and say, like, don't report on this, or you reported that wrong, or think more carefully before reporting that again, or try to get them to not run a story. Like, that is part of like the influence game that always happens. Now, there is a question of where is that line, though, because there could be a line in which if the government strays too far and does something that really threatens them, that's different. But just urging them not to do something, or to change the way they're looking at things, or to, you know, get more evidence or something along those lines, that's part of the natural functioning of government.
Yeah, this was like a huge moment, I think. I remember like kind of Googling and seeing who had worked for, if there, I knew Kavanaugh and Kagan had worked for the executive. And so they were going to be, they were going to find this laughable. And like, no one is more surprised than me to be like, go Kavanaugh, when I'm listening to these oral arguments. Like, let me be clear. But yeah, like, it was like both he and Kagan were breaths of sanity in this, of just kind of like, this is business as usual, guys. What do you think goes on? You bring up a really important point, which is that the loops in this idea that like all of these internet Supreme Court cases are somehow related in various ways. I want to give it a little bit of airtime, which is the idea that when Kagan was doing this, she was like, you know, have you not heard of the Pentagon Papers? Have you not heard of all of these moments where people have called up and screamed at editors not to publish things? I mean, what is the famous like line for Watergate? Graham's tit will be in a ringer or something, like when it was a really, but this is a family newspaper, we're not going to run that line by like Ben Brantley. Anyways, it's like, sorry, it's in All the President's Men, which is a great movie about kind of this idea, but basically like really like some similar kind of like stuff, and like they publish it anyways. And that was also the thing that happened over and over again with Twitter, and this type of thing, was that there was no direct injury. Like there was no traceability between these emails or these texts or these messages coming from the White House, coming from any type of government official, and there being censorship. For one, most of the people had never been censored. None of their posts had come down. Their accounts hadn't been banned. The most that they could claim was kind of like, oh, we've been like shadow banned or like banned on like the Twitter trends thing. It was just like really crazy. But what Kagan's analysis of like, hey, we used to have these calls a million times a day to press, really did was say, hey, the platforms are press. The platforms are newspapers. The platforms are media companies. And this was not just Kagan. Even, and I think most notably, you saw Alito many times referencing the platforms as if like, and describing them and analogizing them to newspapers. Why is this so significant? Well, 3 weeks before Murthy, in the panoply of internet law cases that have come before the Supreme Court in the last 2 years, was NetChoice, which I am assuming that that your listeners are familiar with, because it has been huge and is far more significant case, honestly, even than Murthy. And what people struggled with, you heard the justices struggling with in the NetChoice cases, was trying to understand how to analogize them under a First Amendment doctrine. And the strongest, from a tech perspective, that they were looking for was basically the most kind of like pro-tech, but most kind of, I think for the good guys, for our kind of like things that we kind of think, or like the general take we take, is that content moderation is a necessary evil that happens. And part of what allows it to happen under the law is understanding these platforms as some type of media company, in the way the Miami Herald doesn't have to carry every single argument in an op-ed on a topic. It can just pick one person's argument and publish that. And that itself is its own First Amendment right as a newspaper and a media entity under the First Amendment. And so that had been one of the analogies floated in NetChoice. It was probably the most pro-tech analogy. Right. And what you heard in Murthy was all of the justices referring to the platforms as newspapers, which I'm really sorry, just from a very kind of psychological standpoint, is you don't divorce yourself from that analogy. Like when you decide one case and suddenly stop thinking about it as that in another case. And so I think it was a very huge, very big tell for how like also NetChoice will possibly come out, because I think that they were kind of like, well, we kind of see this necessary evil that's happening. We see this thing that's happening. This is lawful but awful speech. And it's nice to have these intermediary players that are doing this job for us.
Yeah. I mean, that it was interesting, especially obviously Alito. And again, like the context, he referred to, you know, he analogized the platforms to the press multiple times, including including the time I mentioned with like, oh, you know, we would never allow that to happen where Kagan and Kavanaugh jumped in. But yeah, I mean, I hope that that's right. We'll see, obviously, very soon or within a few months, you know, how the net choice cases come out. But I think I'm hopeful that you're right, that the fact that they were just 3 weeks after hearing that case were so quick to refer to them in similar contexts as newspapers, that maybe they have all sort of come around to that, and that bodes well for the net choice cases. In terms of this particular case, I mean, how do you think it's gonna play out?
I think that they're going to find they're going to kind of like dismiss this on standing grounds. So, kind of what I mean by that is, I think that when Sotomayor said things like "there's just not there's the, like this nothing burger with deception sauce on it," is basically kind of like, I think that that's her saying there's just no direct injury here. You don't have a claim. And so one of the key elements of like even bringing something in the very first instance is like basically having a colorable claim that like you have an injury that needs to be redressed. And, and you know, as you described so well, the 151 page, totally off the charts district court decision that both kept us up for two nights, like that we're just like, is no one seeing the reality here? What is going on? Like, how are we, like, are we being gaslit? What's happening? It felt so great to have like a couple of the justices be like, what is happening here? I'm like, oh, thank God. Like, there was like, I'm not insane. Like, there's actually like something. This is actually garbage. And this is like conspiracy theories that are reaching this, like they're wasting the time of the court. But like, I think that they're going to, so that's what I think they're going to do. I think it's the neatest. And I think that Alito, because of his, I don't make my business reading Supreme Court tea leaves, but Alito will probably write some type of dissent or concurrence that basically says that he thinks that something bad is happening here. Maybe this wasn't it, but there should be like that. Maybe it will be right the next time. And also, by the way, we should really look at like, we shouldn't have reviewed it under this standard. We should have given more deference to the trial court, which was also bullshit. So anyways, whatever. That's like, that's kind of that. And, you know, and Thomas will join in that for old times' sake.
I mean, the thing that, so to me, like the ideal that would have come out of this case, and in theory, I guess it could bounce back down and then come back up again. The ideal thing that would have come out of this case was an actual clearer standard for jawboning, whether we like the term or not, that says this is what is allowed and this is what is not. Because as it stands today, really, you're right. The only thing we have is the Bantam Books case, which is whatever, 60 years old, and is not very clear and is in a very different sort of situation. But, you know, I fear that, you know, I mean, so if they just dismiss it for standing, which is possible, then, you know, do we just go through this whole argument again some other way in another couple of years?
Of course. That is literally how this works, Mike. Welcome to lawyer. This is like, sometimes you say things that most of the time I forget you're not a lawyer, but then sometimes you say things like this. Like, oh, yeah, Mike's not a lawyer.
Oh, I deserve that. Okay.
I'm like, yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, my dude. Yeah, we're going to be back here again. That's exactly right. You wanted a nice, clear test that made sense to everyone. That's cute.
I can dream.
I know. I mean, like, I remember talking to Jeff Kosoff about this, and Jeff was like, oh, like, that's like, you know, like, we need a clearer test. Can't they make a clearer test? I'm like, Jeff, what planet are you on? There's no way that we're getting a clearer test on this. This court is on such a defensive, they are on, I mean, and that's actually the best we can hope for, I think, actually.
Right.
I don't want new law from this court. Like, this court is not, like, it's just so frankly, like this is, I mean, it's not that there aren't brilliant people on it, but the moment right now and the facts that they're being presented with and just everything, I don't really want a ton of new law. And so like, I'm fine punting, actually. I mean, it would be better if we had more clear law in it, like on bantam books and jawboning, 100%. I mean, I would also say the same for like copyright similarity judgment and like a whole bunch of other things that we can like throw into and that thing. But like, there's going to be some vague tests and like, they're going to keep existing. And I'm like, I would rather that than and some clarity on what happened here with direct injury and everything else. Then this court be in charge of making a new test under First Amendment doctrine.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And this is, you know, very clearly not a good case on which to necessarily make that call.
I do feel like, and I wanted to ask you a question, which is like, do you think that the court's getting better at internet law cases? Because I do. Like, and I'm like a little more sophisticated. I thought Amy Coney Barrett was actually had some great questions about DMs. I thought that like the questions in NetChoice around Etsy were super, I think that Sotomayor was like, no, it's not Pruneyard because it's not, you're not asking on the side, you're not asking in the hallways of the mall. You're walking into the Abercrombie and Fitch and protesting. You're making them serve you up an Orange Julius that has like mango in it, you know, like they don't, you know, they don't make mango Orange Juliuses. Like, stop making them make you them. Like, right. Like, so I thought that this was, you know, I think that the analogy is and the understanding is getting a little bit better, but I'm curious about your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering how much of that is, you know, and as someone who filed amicus briefs in a bunch of these cases lately, like how much of it is down to the fact that there have been like so many amicus briefs filed in a bunch of these cases, and I mean certainly plenty of like totally garbage ones and useless ones, but also some really really thoughtful ones that really express why the court should be so careful and thoughtful and sort of filling in all of the gaps that might have been missed if it was just done on the arguments from the two parties and also the US government in like NetChoice case where they got to show up also. And so it does feel like at the very least, and this became clear in the Gonzalez and Tamna cases last year, the Supreme Court realizes that they're doing something substantial here, that when they're dealing with internet and internet speech, it's not something that they can just sort of toss off an opinion, that what they do will have a huge, huge impact. And I think, you know, whether it's simply just the number of amicus briefs on both sides of people just saying, like, be fucking careful, that they recognize, like, okay, we actually do have to try and understand this a little bit, and where we don't understand it, we should tread really carefully. So that's at least, you know, as a non-lawyer, non-expert on this subject,
like honestly better than 99% of the lawyers I talk to, Mike. I didn't mean that as a slander. I just meant that like sometimes like there's like these moments of like,
yes,
won't government and like litigation save us? And then I'm like, that's funny. Like, but I mean, to that point, like one of the things that I really want to, and I think that you and I have a lot of colleagues and people who work in various aspects of civil society and do work in litigation and are members of the press. And can I say the five-alarm fire that has been on for the last 2 years, just on all of this state action from all of these individual states and the Gonzalez and Tamna case on top of that. And then like, you know, I don't even like, I mean, maybe your readers don't or your listeners don't know, but I'm like in Paris right now covering the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act out of the EU, which is like the most major regulation that's going to like globally happen for the next 10, 15 years. And because I don't see the US ever getting its act together on this. Like none of that, there's no one else here because everyone is still back in the US fighting these tiny crazy conspiracy theory fires.
Yes.
And it's such a they're fighting these like, hey, Utah, don't you, haven't you ever read a First Amendment? But it doesn't matter. Like, as I keep pointing out to people, and this is actually a thing I have to remind my law students of all the time, which is like, anyone, like, yes, you can pass a law. It can be illegal. It's not illegal until a judge says it's illegal. Like, and that's a lot of resources to like kind of put into fighting that and creating a record and doing all of that. And if you forum shop it, then those resources are even more depleted because you go all the way up to the court and have to have it shot down. And it's exhausting. And we have like, you know, there's not an infinite number of people that can do this type of work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know certainly, I mean, for us in particular, but I know for lots of folks in civil society, it's been absolutely exhausting. Everybody is completely, you know, worn out because, you know, suddenly it's like, oh, you know, Indiana's doing this and no, Montana's doing that and Louisiana's doing this and you know, keeping up with each of these things and feeling like if you're not there, then bad stuff is going to happen. Is absolutely exhausting. It's extremely frustrating. I have sort of likened it to just a denial of service attack, you know, where it's like people can't keep up in terms of trying to explain to each state like why these laws are so problematic.
Oh, I mean, I think that even the right has acknowledged that that's what part of their strategy.
Sure.
Like, I think that is part of their strategy. It is like just to exhaust. It is just to exhaust the resources. And I think that that's, you know, it's fair game, I guess, in this like kind of like in this system, but it's really crappy and I'm very tired and I'm not even as tired as like you or Daphne Keller or like any of the other, or like, you know, 8 million other people that have been filing like these briefs and doing all this hard work. I'm like, that's nice. I don't write to meet you. Like, that's like, have fun. Like, I'll sign on, but like when I read it, but you know, it's, but yeah, anyways, I just think that there's also that part of this, which is, you know, and I'm not even going to talk about the fact that like every time civil society has to rise to an occasion like this, or litigators have to rise to an occasion like this, like also so do all of the companies, and that costs them tons and tons and tons of money for every single state action, and like not just lobbyists, but litigators. And then, you know, and like, so like the costs keep piling on and, you know, at some point, that kind of strains product and other types of things. I don't know. It's just kind of interesting ecosystem. So,
and I'll use this to close it out. But like the, you know, one thing that I've noticed, especially in part because of like what's happening in the EU, which I'll note, we should have you back on the podcast to talk about what's going on in the EU, since you're there now and studying that. But it feels to me that even the biggest companies are now much more willing to negotiate, even here in the States, because they're saying, well, there's a bunch of stuff we need to do for the EU, so we're fine with settling for that in the US, because we, as the biggest companies, can handle it, whereas the smaller companies might not. That's not the biggest company's concern. And so they seem much more willing to compromise now in the US, even in situations where I really think they shouldn't. And I think that may do some real harm to smaller companies. But we'll see.
I completely agree. We'll see. We disagree about so much, Mike. You also have to have me back on to talk about protocols, not platforms, in which like I think that I really want to like have a conversation separately, maybe at some point, about how your grand vision, once it was achieved in the last 2 years, how you think that, I mean, maybe I can flip the tables and interview you about it, because I think this is like a fascinating question. But anyways, you can clip this out later. But I just think it's a great, I mean, there's lots of stuff that we have to talk about, but I think that everything you said is correct, and that the idea of all of this litigation and all of the multi-jurisdictional aspect of it, it's just, you know, it's just like an eight-dimensional Tetris game. It's really, truly like not something that is ever boring or ever or ever kind of, I mean, it's absolutely unpredictable, but it's never boring. So that, you know, I'll give you that for our jobs.
Yes, yes. There's always something to be writing about, talking about, etc. But on that note, we will conclude this particular podcast. We'll definitely have you back on again soon. I'm sure I'll find some other weird reason for you to join us. Thank you very much for taking the time and being willing to do this all the way from across the Atlantic. And thank you everyone who is listening as well, and we'll be back next week. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get